Lord, while others, the rest of the people, receive favor through us.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
An outplacement firm reports U.S. layoffs jumped more than five times in February from a year earlier. According to the new report, so far this year, employers have announced plans to eliminate 180,713 jobs, up 427% from the 34,309 cuts announced in the first 2 months of 2022, the study showed. It is reportedly the highest January-February total since 2009. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, layoffs by U.S. companies over January and February touched the highest since 2009, with the tech sector accounting for more than a third of over 180,000 job cuts announced. A report showed recently, in February alone, layoffs in the United States of America stood at 77,770, more than five times higher than the 15,245 job cuts announced a year earlier, according to the report from employment firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas Incorporation. Reuters, in another report, wrote, the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits increased by the most in 5 months last week, but the underlying trend remained consistent with a tight labor market. American employers announced 77,770 job cuts in February, marking a 410% increase from the same month last year. Executive coaching firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas Incorporation has revealed. RT noted, according to the report issued earlier this week, February's total was the highest for the month since 2009, when 186,350 job cuts were recorded. However, the figure was down 24% on the 102,943 cuts announced in January. So far this year, employers have announced plans to eliminate 180,713 jobs, up 427% from 34,309 cuts announced in the first 2 months of 2022, the study showed. It is reportedly the highest January-February total since 2009. Certainly, employers are paying attention to rate increase plans from the Fed. Many have been planning for a downturn for months, cutting costs elsewhere. The company's senior vice president, Andrew Challenger, stated, adding, if things continue to cool, layoffs are typically the last piece in company cost-cutting strategies. RT added, the report indicated that technology companies axed the most jobs last month, with the figure hitting 21,387. The tech sector has announced 35% of all job cuts in 2023. Right now, the overwhelming bulk of cuts are occurring in technology. Retail and financial are also cutting right now, as consumer spending matches economic conditions. In February, job cuts occurred in all 30 industries Challenger tracks, Andrew Challenger added. Meanwhile, the study showed hiring was down, with companies having announced plans to recruit 28,830 workers in February, a decline of 87% in annual terms. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English noted Bank of America Chief Executive Brian Moynihan has predicted the United States will enter a recession later this year despite improving signs for the global economy. Speaking at a business summit in Sydney, Australia, Moynihan said the U.S. economy is on track for a technical recession, defined as two consecutive quarters of negative growth in the third quarter. Our base projection is for a recession to occur in U.S. economy beginning in the third quarter of 2023, occur through the fourth quarter of 2023, and into the first quarter of 2024, Moynihan said during an appearance at the Financial Review's Business Summit recently. Moynihan said he anticipates the economy to contract in each quarter between 0.5% and 1%, resulting in a very slight recession in the schemes of things, and for interest rates to start falling in the second quarter of next year. He said, I don't think you will see a very deep recession. Moynihan said the slowdown will be mild enough that a lot of people are not going to see that much of it. He said it will be more of a technical recession than it will be a deep drop in the U.S.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. What we're going to do is actually dive into some of the rules related to the fasting and prayers of the travelers, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, as I said in the beginning or introduction to this episode, let's start talking about some of the travelers, prayers and fasting and some of the rules which are related to set of rules or jurisprudence, right? Let me begin by asking this question. You know, when we hear that, one of the most important changes that happened to the traveler's prayer is that they become, for example, shortened. Right?
Yes.
This is what we hear. So my question is that does this obligation of shortening the prayers or the units of the prayers by a traveler apply to all of the prayers, all of the obligatory prayers, or it's confined or limited to only some of these prayers?
Well, that's a good question. I would like to clarify the issue by saying that the obligation of shortening the prayers applies to some daily prayers, not to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And those prayers which are shortened are the prayers which consist of four units or four cycles. They include the noon prayer, the afternoon Asr prayer, and the Isha prayer. And these are the three daily wajib prayers which must be shortened in the event that a person travels the required distance. For example, a distance of 44 kilometers, which is which are equal to 8 farsakh. Now, with that said, I would further say that the other prayers, like, for example, Isha prayer, the Maghrib prayers, or Fajr prayer, they cannot be shortened, okay? For example, if you shorten the Maghrib prayer, which consists of three units, it cannot be shortened into two units or into one unit. So that's not permissible. And as far as the Mustahab prayers are concerned, they are always in twos. Okay, the Mustahab prayers, the Nawafil, they are performed in two rakats always. And there's only one prayer which is which consists of one rakah, and that is Witr prayer. Okay, and that is the prayer which is offered at midnight. That's the night prayer, part of one of the rakats of the night prayers. So that is what I would say based on the opinions of the old religious authorities. This is a matter of consensus and not a matter of discrepancy or difference of opinion. And the scholars are all agreed in this regard.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the rules and regulations about the travelers' prayer and fasting with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, what are the conditions for the four rak'ah or four unit prayers to become obligatorily shortened on the traveler?
This is, of course, the most important question when it comes to shortening the prayers or qasr of the prayers. According to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there are eight conditions which must be taken into consideration. I should be very quick to mention all these, all those conditions. The first one is the travel distance. One who travels must travel at least eight continuous farsakh. The outward and return distance, at least the outward and return distance, must be 8 farsakh.
We are not talking about one way.
Yeah,
we are talking about also the return.
Yeah, even the outward and return. If you, for example, travel 22 kilometers.
0.5, I think.
It is because 8 farsakh, according to the religious scholars, 1 farsakh is equal to 4.5 kilometers. Okay. So it is on the whole 44 kilometers. 44 kilometers. Mm-hmm. Maybe there could be some, the scholars might differ in their opinions about mm-hmm. how much a farsakh is. But on the whole, we let's understand that 8 farsakh should be covered.
It's about 22 kilometers.
It's about 22 in the outward distance, and the return distance should also be 22. And 22...
On the aggregate, about 45 kilometers.
Yeah, about 45 or 4, okay, uh-huh. 44 kilometers. Now, with that said, that's the first condition.
Right.
And then the second condition, the intention to travel the distance should exist from the time of the departure, you know. If, for example, one does not have such an intention, and if he happens to travel this distance, the 44 kilometers, he cannot break his fast, and also cannot shorten his prayers because he happened to travel this distance. Mm-hmm. He did not have in the beginning, in the very outset, he did not have such an intention. So therefore, he cannot shorten his prayers. But of course, on return, for example, if a person happens to travel without having the intention to travel, if he travels this distance without having the intention to travel 8 farsakh, mm-hmm. but he happens to travel, and then on return back home, he wants to get back home, so the distance is there, and he intends to go back home. The distance is 44 kilometers. Of course, in that case, he should shorten his prayer mm-hmm. and, of course, break his fast also. Now, this is the second condition. The third condition is the continuity of the intention, mm-hmm. you know. The traveler should maintain his intention throughout the journey. And if one changes his mind, or you know, before covering the Shari Farsakh, or he hesitates, the rule of travel will not apply to him, you know. And therefore, it's very important that the intention must be maintained throughout the journey. So this is the third condition, and mm-hmm. the fourth condition. There should be no intention mm-hmm. to interrupt one's journey mm-hmm. while covering the distance by passing through one's own hometown, or by intending to stay 10 days or more in another place. For example, if you have got two hometowns or two watan, as they say, you know, if you intend to pass through your hometown and then go to another place, you cannot shorten your prayer, because the moment you arrive in your hometown, you're not a traveler. You must offer complete prayers. Mm-hmm. You must, you must observe fast, and you must respect you must fulfill the duties of a person who is not a traveler. Mm-hmm. So that is important.
I see.
And of course, if you intend to stay at a place, while you are going out and you're traveling on your way to a place you intend to stay for 10 days, okay?
I see.
You cannot shorten your prayers, mm-hmm. Of course.
Okay, very quick question, because we don't have much time. When you say hometown, what do you mean? Like the place of your residence, or the place where you're from, like you're born in?
It's not necessary to be born in a place mm-hmm. in order for that place to be called your hometown. It could be the place where you are born, or the place where you have stayed there for a long time. For mm-hmm. example, if you have lived in a city which is not originally your hometown, basically, or maybe it's not your birthplace, and even it's not the country where mm-hmm. you belong to.
Yes.
So you lived in a city for, let's say, for 2 years or more than 2 years, okay? That city is your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
That
thank you
city
much.
Is your
hometown. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. If someone's priority is the other world, he will bear the hardships in this world. In part of Ayah 10 of Surah Az-Zumar, we read, Indeed, the patient will be paid in full, their reward without any reckoning. The patients in this ayah refer to those people who tolerate the hard situations sincerely. They are also thankful towards Allah, and they never replace Allah with mundane worlds. Now, which one do we prefer, our body or our soul? Unfortunately, people of today's world prefer body to their soul, so they spend more for their body. Those who prefer Allah over anything else in their lives, they will reach sincerity. If they prefer the hereafter, they will reach patience over difficulties. If they prefer soul over the body, they will do righteous deeds. Thus, faith in Allah, the hereafter and soul, will save us from Satan in this world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Almost a decade since foreign-backed terrorists in Syria tried to pull the country into chaos, it seems an all-out war against Damascus has failed. That's according to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. In a meeting with a large group of influential figures from various Arab and Islamic countries, Said Hassan Nasrallah asserted that many Arab states intend to normalize ties with Syria, but the United States opposes such moves. The Hezbollah chief stressed that Syria's real enemy is the United States, which is going ahead with its war and blockade against Damascus. He argued that Syria has been targeted by a U.S.-led scheme over its rejection to subdue to Washington. He pointed out that Washington's sanction measures against Damascus are failing with the help of the people and Syria's regional allies. In the televised address, Nasrallah hailed Syria for lying in the heart of a powerful axis of resistance, noting that there is confidence that the Arab country would remain at the forefront of the struggle to stand against the West. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the entire region. The Hezbollah leader also tied the security of Syria to its neighboring countries, namely Lebanon. He said what happens in Syria and Palestine is reflected directly on the regional countries and has a strong impact on Lebanon in particular. The prominent figure said speaking about the present and future of Syria is like speaking about the present and future of Lebanon. He noted that if Daesh terrorists, who had seized large swathes of land in Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2017, had remained in the region, it would have affected Lebanon as well. The comments by Hezbollah leader comes as many countries, especially those in the Arab world, are gradually turning towards Syria by normalizing relations with the Arab country. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Oman are among those who have recently restored their relations with Damascus. To add to the list is Tunisia, with President Rais Said announcing plans to fully restore ties with Syria, which was once cut off more than a decade ago. Needless to say that many of those countries join hand in hand with Western nations to sow division in Syria. They also helped the West impose an all-out economic sanction and blockade on Damascus. As Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has numerously said, hegemonic countries had implemented straitjacketed agendas, invested in terrorism, and put economies in a stranglehold with no regard for international law. Miqdad brands what he calls smart sanctions as a form of collective punishment against the Syrian people who are deprived of access to food, fuel, medications, and other basic necessities. As part of sanctions, the Western world has left no stone unturned to isolate Syria. But to what extent has that scheme been successful? Since the crisis in 2011, Syria has favored dialogue even with the opposition to support national reconciliation and stability. Moreover, Damascus has facilitated the return of millions of refugees who once escaped a foreign-backed militancy from Syria. The Syrian government has also made all its efforts to rebuild the country after large swathes of its land were devastated by terrorist acts. From the military perspective, President Bashar al-Assad, with the support of Iran and Russia, has emerged victorious from the years-long conflict. That could especially be highlighted when the Syrian government managed to retake almost all the territory it lost to foreign-backed terrorists. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is the fact that Syria, with the help of its allies, is managing to stand firm against the West's threats. From partitioning the Arab country to plundering the country's oil, Syria is doing whatever it can to resist against the West. That's exactly what the Hezbollah leader termed as failure of the West in its war on Damascus.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Aban; Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani; and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. While considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There is no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling, open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Bourne has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly, but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and their regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. but the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved in the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we took the oil, and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its programs to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atan, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, for today's discussion, we want to talk about this topic. Why no woman was selected as a prophet or imam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we are talking about, selection of a woman as a prophet, first of all, it's helpful if we distinguish between two terms. We have two different terms regarding prophethood. One of them is Nabi, and the other is Rasul. Maybe some people translate Nabi as prophet and Rasul as messenger. So the point is that every Rasul is a Nabi, every messenger is a prophet, but not every prophet is a messenger, meaning that it was only the duty of some of the prophets to preach the religion. And for some prophets, they were only receiving some revelation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They were only Nabi receiving the revelation. But maybe they did not have the responsibility for preaching among all people around them. They were, those who have this responsibility are called Rasul. I'm not trying to say that this is the only difference. This is one of the differences which are given by some scholars between Nabi and Rasul. So with that, I would come to another point regarding Nubuwwa. There is another technical term. We have Nubuwwa Inba'i and Nubuwwa Tashri'i. Yes. Nubuwwa Inba'i means just receive revelation and inspiration from God. But Nubuwwa Tashri'i means that no, it's not only about receiving. You receive some laws from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala regarding Sharia and legislation, and then you will preach and tell the people about all these laws. Now the question is that, is it possible for a woman to receive revelation from God or inspiration? The answer is positive. And the Quran is very explicitly in saying that.
You mean the concept of wahy?
Exactly.
Okay.
Some women, they received wahy from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have the story of the mother of Moses alayhi salam. It's very clear from the Quran.
Yuqabat.
According to some books. Her name is Yuqabat. So she received some revelations, or if you may call it inspiration, it doesn't make any difference. And more important than her is Lady Maryam salamullahi alayha. According to many verses, he received some inspirations and revelations. And more important than all, Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha. According to many narrations, especially after the demise of the Prophet, Jibreel used to descend to her, and the book Mus'haf Fatima is what Jibreel dictated, revealed to Lady Salamullahi Alayha, and Imam Alayhi Salam wrote it down after it was dictated by Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. So the point is that it is possible for some women to receive revelation. Does it mean that we can call them prophet? The point is that they just receive the revelation which is only inba'i and not tashri'i. So technically they are not prophet or messengers. But if you want to claim that nubuwwa inba'i can be given to a person who is not a prophet, then we may accept them as those people receiving nubuwwa inba'i. So the point is that, technically speaking, they are not called Nabi or Rasul or Prophet or Messenger. But does it mean that they are not able to receive the revelation? No. The answer is that, as the Quran says, as the narration says, we have special women in the history of humankind, like Mother of Moses, Maryam Salamullah Alayha, and Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha. All of them, they received revelation. This is one point. Second of all, when it comes to the issue of spirituality and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, again, the Quran is very clear in that there is no difference between men and women. Allah says that all people who act righteously, min dhakarin aw untha, whether they are male or female, then the reward will be given to them on the Day of Judgment, and there is no difference between them. Or لَنُحِيَنَّهُ حَيَاتًا طَيِّبًا, a pure life is given to a male or female who are believers and they act righteously. So we know that unlike in Islam, in some other religions or schools of thought, even the worship of women is not accepted. But the Quran says that no, there is no difference. When it comes to spirituality, there is no difference. Even according to some people believe that according to some mystics like Ibn Arabi, in some cases, women have more potential when it comes to spirituality and mysticism. But having said that, we come to the question whether the we have any, woman chosen as a prophet or imam.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
When we refer to the Old Testament, the books accepted by the Jews and Christians, the answer is positive. We see some women who are called prophet. But the point is that their definition of prophet is different from our definition of prophet. So we cannot claim that this is, a source which can tell us that some women were chosen as prophet. The Quran does not refer to any woman as a prophet. The narrations also do not talk about that. We said that when it comes to receiving the revelation, the answer is positive. But the point is that according to the majority of the scholars, it's not a deficiency for women not to be selected as a woman or as an imam. And the reason is that prophethood, especially if you are a messenger, an imamate, is not only receiving some revelations. No, it's also a social, political, cultural, and military, maybe, responsibility. So we know that Islam, when it comes to these responsibilities, in the majority of the cases, all these responsibilities are given to men. And it is just because of the difference in the structure, physical structure of men and women. And of course, on the other side, when it comes to emotional responsibilities, they are given to, mainly they are given to the ladies and women and mothers. So it has nothing to do with regard to the status of women and men before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All of them are the same in terms of spirituality. They can reach the greatest level. There is no difference. But imagine that, a woman wants to be a prophet going to different people, the wrongdoers, the oppressive rulers, and maybe she needs, to initiate a war or defend herself. They need an army. And all these actions, which even today, I believe that even the feminists, they agree that these actions are expected more from men compared to women. So the point is that the position of prophethood and imamate, they require some responsibilities, which to begin with, they are expected from men and not from women.